all the seeds of the great division in the left between the reformists and the revolutionaries that breaks out between 1914 and 1919, between the collapse of the Second International and the formation of the Third or the Communist International, they're all developing here.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Welcome, everybody, to Haymarket Live. Today we are launching the new book by Mike Tabor, edited by Mike Tabor, Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism, Debates in the Second International, 1900 to 1910. This book is an incredible resource, obviously for historians of the period, but I think especially it's worth noting especially for activists and organizers who are grappling with the immense challenge of building an international movement against capitalism today. That, I think, is who the book is really designed for. And if that describes you, I highly recommend picking up the book from Haymarket, haymarketbooks.org. Just a few words about this this book before we jump into our excellent panel. I think for folks, probably many of you will be aware, but the Second International was one of the most powerful efforts to weld together working people across national boundaries in the 20th century. And it also was indispensable preparatory work for another great effort along those lines in the Third International or Communist International. This book, in particular, by delving into the debates of the International in its formative years, troubles the idea of a kind of coherent and uniform Second International Marxism as a kind of singular set of ideas. And instead, I think it really brings this historic effort to life in a tangible way for those of us grappling with the kind of prospects of socialist organizing today. By looking at the development of these debates, how they came to those positions, and how they what was informing those discussions that led to that, including the numbers on the votes, I think that we can see that there are molecular changes happening throughout these years in response to identifiable international trends. And if you want to understand the historical developments, there's really no better way to follow them than looking at these very live debates. So today I am joined by a panel of the editor of the book, Mike Tabor, along with David McNally, Anne McShane, and Tom Alter. I'll introduce each of our panelists before they start, and then we will have a little time for questions. So I do want to encourage folks, if anything comes up throughout the event, please pop your questions into the live chat and we will try to get to them during the discussion period. Now we'll start with David. David McNally is the Cullen Distinguished Professor of History and Business at the University of Houston and Director of the Center for the Study of Capitalism. McNally is the author of 7 books and has won a number of awards, including the Paul Sweezy Award from the American Sociological Association for his book Global Slump, and the Deutscher Memorial Award for Monsters of the Market. We'll start with you, David. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Thank you, Sean. And a big shout out initially to Haymarket Books, our go-to radical publisher that needs and deserves the support of everyone listening with us today. And also a huge shout out to Mike Tabor. This is an exceptional collection of documents from the Second International across the years 1900 to 1910. But more than that, Mike Tabor gives us a set of introductions to each section that he has crafted that allow us to see that as much as this is indispensable history for socialists today, Mike reads all of this in terms of the present as history. In other words, the ways in which these historical documents speak to critical political debates on the left internationally today. At the core of this, of course, is the famous debate between reform and revolution. But I think as Mike's documents show, this really raises a whole series of issues with respect to attitudes towards the bourgeois nation state, the conceptions of working class struggle and working class self-activity, and finally of working class consciousness. And I want to, as I run through a few of the key aspects of the book, I really want to highlight those. As many of you listening today will know, all of these texts are framed at the outset by the great debate at the end of the 1890s into the first years of the 20th century over so-called revisionism. The argument that Marx's and Engels' revolutionary conception of the relationship of socialist to capitalism needed to be revised, and that the social democratic parties of the left could essentially become parties of gradual and cumulative social reform. In the early going, the revisionist position gets formally defeated. That is to say, as the documents that Mike gives us show, the resolutions passed in 1904 repudiate the idea that, as they put it, social democracy should be, quote, a party contenting itself with the reform of bourgeois society. Contrary to that, they claim to stand for its revolutionary transformation. But incrementally and in practice, the reformist or revisionist position is starting to advance as a practical kind of politics within one of these parties after another. And it raises for us, you know, the key question that's posed for the left in the United States today. Some of you will know that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in an interview in the summer in the New York Times, said, quote, "There's no way in this country you can accrue any kind of power without there being some Faustian compromise," unquote. And the documents that Mike brings to bear help us understand the implications of this idea of a Faustian compromise with the bourgeois nation state, because we see the so-called revisionists, led by Edward Bernstein, openly embracing colonialism. We see them arguing that colonialism ought to simply be taken over by social democracy and civilized. And this is because of their racist notion that there are uncivilized peoples out there. But the point is that rather than seeing themselves as intransigent opponents of everything that their national state stands for, they essentially start to imagine themselves as the heirs to that state, the heirs who will civilize it, universalize it, and make it ostensibly something progressive. And the same debate unfolds over immigration. The question of whether or not socialists support their capitalist nation states restricting and controlling immigration in order to keep out foreigners of various sorts. Not surprisingly, we see members of the left from the white settler colonies of the United States, South Africa, because it's white socialists who are at the congresses from South Africa, and Australia, very often mobilizing quite racist tropes to defend the idea of immigration controls. To their credit, the left on both of those key debates stands up against colonialism in a very uncompromising way, and against all immigration controls for the free movement of the workers of the world. Now, in a moment, I'll say one or two things about the debate over the vote for women and the socialist attitude to war. But I want to just touch on the way in which running through the texts that Mike gives us and the debates in the Congresses of the Second International is the idea that principles and practice are entirely separable. And the Austrian socialist Victor Adler, in the key debate in 1907 over socialist support of universal suffrage for women, that is to say, the vote for all women, Victor Adler comes across and says, quote, "I accept everything in the resolution related to principles." It's a resolution written by Clara Zetkin. "But all that has nothing to do with the implementation of our principles." In other words, principles have nothing, Adler's word, to do with our actual behavior in electoral politics, parliamentary politics, and so on. So principles become something that one pays homage to on May Day while one goes about pragmatic kinds of adaptations to the existing state of affairs, or what we've come to call opportunism. And one of the things that really strikes me about the responses of Clara Zetkin, later Rosa Luxemburg, who I'll finish on in a couple of minutes, to this debate, is that they are emphasizing not just principles, they're emphasizing strategy. They're emphasizing political agency. And so when Clara Zetkin is arguing back over this issue, she doesn't start to quibble over the size of the reform. She argues about its qualitative nature as a demand for mobilization. She says at one point, for instance, quote, "Women need to be awakened, organized, and educated with the same fervor as has been given to the male proletariat." And she refers to the struggle for the vote for women as one that, quote, "uproots old prejudices and shakes up the masses." Notice that emphasis. There are existing levels of consciousness within sections of the working class that need to be shaken up so that the struggle can transform the working class into an agent capable of making its own future and capable of remaking society. And this takes me finally to the debate on socialists and war, because here we get a resolution put forward by, you know, one of the great figures of German social democracy, August Bebel, which calls for socialists to advocate a quick end to any war that breaks out. And Rosa Luxemburg, along with Lenin, draft an amendment to this resolution over war, in which they not only call for the speedy termination of war, but they argue that social democracy must, quote, "employ all their forces to utilize the economic and political crisis created by the war in order to rouse the masses and thereby hasten the downfall of capitalist class rule." In other words, the revolutionary left is beginning to cohere around the idea that there is a passivity and a fatalism that's come in through the door of over-reliance on electoral and parliamentary politics, where insurgency from below is being de-emphasized in favor of parliamentary activity from above. And Luxemburg finishes one of her interventions in the 1907 debate with the statement, quote, "The dialectics of history does not mean that we wait with arms folded until it bears fruit." And so what Mike is showing us through these documents is that all the seeds of the great division in the left between the reformists and the revolutionaries that breaks out between 1914 and 1919, between the collapse of the Second International and the formation of the Third, or the Communist International, they're all developing here we can see them in formation, and that these key debates of the international left today are therefore vital for the socialist left that we are trying to build around the world. And for all of that, we owe Mike huge thanks for bringing these debates to life for us.
Thanks so much, David. A lot to dig into there, and we will during our discussion period. But for now, we will hear next from Anne McShane. Anne McShane is a Marxist, a historian of the early Soviet women's movement, and a human rights lawyer specializing in representing asylum seekers. She has a long history of involvement in both the British and the Irish working class and left-wing movements. She contributes regular articles to the Weekly Worker, the Journal of the British-based CPGB, and occasional pieces for Jacobin. She writes on Irish politics and the historical struggle to connect women's liberation with the socialist project. She's currently writing on the work of the Women's Department of the CPSU of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Zhenotel, in Soviet Central Asia, having completed a PhD on the subject in 2019 at Glasgow University. She is based in Cork, Ireland. Anne, take it away.
Oh, thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me to take part in this discussion. So I've been a big fan of Mike's work, in particular this volume and the volume before it, Under the Socialist Banner. I have found these debates to be incredibly inspiring, and I think that they provide us with an opportunity to reflect on this important part of our history. So I see it as our history just as much as the history of the Russian Revolution is part of our history. It's a history of our movement at a particular stage. So as Sean has said, I work representing asylum seekers. And today, actually, I was at a conference on asylum seekers, on vulnerable migrants in Europe. And obviously, as you can imagine, it's not a pretty picture at all. The situation is extremely fraught. It's like, you know, dangerous, actually, in many ways to be an asylum seeker in Europe. Now, homelessness is a huge problem. Many asylum seekers are sleeping on the streets of cities throughout Europe. This is very different to how it was maybe 10, 15 years ago, when the kind of formal guarantees that were given by the EU actually had some reality. But the situation has changed a great deal. So what this discussion is about and has been about in Europe, and I'd be interested to hear what comrades, if you are able to discuss this, if you have a thought on this, want to say, is about asylum seekers, genuine asylum seekers, and people who are just here for economic reasons. And so for there's the successful and the unsuccessful, the person who can put forward often a good story at interview, be able to mobilize all of their trauma in an effective way to convince a bureaucrat in the International Protection Office of the Irish state will be successful, whereas somebody who's less able to do that for whatever reason, or genuinely has an economic reason, will just be booted out unceremoniously. And the truth of it, as far as I'm concerned, is that many times these things cannot be disassociated. You know, your experience of living in a civil war situation, your experience of poverty, all of these things contribute to creating a situation where you feel forced to leave your homeland and travel far to find a new way of life. And people do all want to work. And so I think in a way, my view is that the left has got too caught up in this debate around asylum and non-asylum seekers. In Ireland, we have this slogan that people like raise as asylum seekers welcome here. And again, I think that that feeds into this concept of the deserving and the undeserving migrants, and the undeserving migrants being the migrants who are traveling for economic reasons. And in contrast to that, the socialist international the Second International had a very straightforward perspective. Now, I'm not saying that it wasn't countered and that there were debates. And as you can see in Mike's book, there were such interesting debates and provocative debates on the subject. And what I think is just so interesting and so kind of inspiring about it is that they just see these people as members of the working class. The working class is on the move globally. This is a situation that's been created by capitalism. What is our answer to this? So the left are saying our answer to this is to organize these people into trade unions, to integrate them into the working class of the country that they're coming to fight for their protections, and to demand that they, you know, act in accordance with, you know, the rules of our trade unions and our organizations, that they don't become strike breakers, that we don't allow that to happen. And then the right wing, as we've seen in Mike's book, as expressed in particular by the American comrades, well, I don't know, should I call him comrades? But like, is the idea that there's a pro bono working man who's welcome in the United States or in Australia or in South Africa, as David said. And then there's these unpaid slave labor, they don't even call them people, like a labor force that would, you know, want to be brought in by capitalism from Japan and from China and from various other countries, from Africa as well. And this component is there to directly and intentionally break the conditions of the workers. So in a way, I don't agree with David that this is just about racism. There's definitely racism in there, but the idea is about protectionism, isn't it? About like the workers, the trade unions wanting to protect their conditions and fearing that these outside forces will come in and undermine them. And, you know, so therefore it's best that they keep them out and argue to keep them out. It also does reflect a very particular approach to what is to socialism, what their socialism is, which I think is more of a kind of a national socialism built on the territory of their own nation state, perhaps in a federation internationally, rather than open global, you know, socialism that people can move around in and can have actually real democracy within. So I think that like some of the arguments that were had in that debate are just so like interesting, and you can see that you can see the passion in the debate, which is what another thing that I really like about the book. You can see the living reality of this debate, of how, you know, when some of the advocates of freedom of movement stand up and speak, how, you know, there's applause, there's a great deal of support behind them. And then you have, obviously, in the book is 1904 and 1907. And then in 1907, you have the sharpest debates and you have a resolution at the end of this. And that in itself, I think, is worth like reflecting on that resolution, because I think what it shows, as David said, in terms of militarism, it shows the impact of the Marxist left on the international. It shows how, despite all the odds, they were able to really put their imprimatur on the resolution. What happened afterwards obviously wasn't as positive as what was on paper following the debate. But I think it's interesting, like, firstly, they agree. It seems to me a little bit of a concession to the opponents of free movement, is that they agree that they will campaign against indentured labour, against indentured labour, but then for everybody else that comes in, or perhaps even for those people who come in, they'll fight for them to have full rights. And also what they argue, what they agree, is that they will organise workers from the very beginning. So they're travelling from one parts of the world to the other, and they'll try to organise them so that they're not travelling in inhuman conditions, as they often were. I mean, I live in Cove near Cork City, and it was one of the places where the what they called the coffin ships would leave from to go to the United States, and you can go to the local museum and you can see the, you know, terrible conditions that people were in on those crossings. So they were fighting for the working class, the socialist movement, to kind of take control of the process, to have its own agenda and its own vision. And to me, despite all the problems, I think it shows that the International was a very an ambitious project in many ways, to, you know, wanted to take on and transcend the agenda of capitalism at that period in history. And there's many criticisms, as I said, that can be made. There's many more things I could say, but I think I leave it at that for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Anne. Great to have a little provocation as well for our future discussions. We will turn it now over to Tom Alter. Tom Alter is an assistant professor of history at Texas State University, where he specializes in labor and working class history. He is the author of Toward a Cooperative Commonwealth: The Transplanted Roots of Farmer Labor Radicalism in Texas, and has been involved in labor and social justice movement activism for nearly 30 years. Take it away, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here today or tonight, depending on where in the world you are. I think it's appropriate that we have an international panel and audience for the Second International. And thanks to Haymarket Books for organizing this, and especially to Mike Tabor for putting together this valuable book. My comments are going to be centered around a general appreciation of the Second International. And for myself, this is a newfound appreciation due to Mike's book and in light of the current state of the socialist movement in the United States and internationally. The Second International, understandably, and in many instances deservedly so, provokes negative comments. I became a socialist around 1994, and at this time, many socialists, like generations before me, looked to the Third International in the years after the Bolshevik Revolution and before the death of Lenin in 1924. The Third International was a truly international, while the Second International was not, primarily consisting of European countries along with the United States, Canada, Australia, and a sprinkling of other representations. The Second International, in my old view, was one of parliamentary debates within bourgeois legislatures, while the Third International was about world revolution of the working class. And while the Third International stood up to imperialism and for national liberation, the Second International collapsed in the face of inter-imperialist war. While I wish we were at the stage where the documents of the Third International are what we need most, we are rather at a stage where the documents of the Second International are of incredible value to revolutionary socialists today. And thanks to Mike and Haymarket Books, we have this weapon in our arsenal. So what can we appreciate about the Second International today? First of all, it was thoroughly Marxist in its composition. Yes, there were different interpretations of Marxism and heated debates over these interpretations, but it's still at the base, the agreement of coming together of the Second International was Marxism, that society is divided into hostile classes, and that the only revolutionary class is the working class, and that only a working class revolution that overthrows the capitalist class and puts the working class majority in power can save humanity from capitalism's endless cycle of war and economic misery. I am a member of the Democratic Socialist of America, and I'm going to be careful not to speak in absolutes. There are many good people in the DSA doing incredible work in a wide and diverse number of issues. and some younger and some older members who are new to working class politics are still working out their understandings of Marxism and can and will be won over to actual Marxism. While today many socialists, in particular those in the DSA, may call themselves Marxist, their concept of Marxism begins and ends with a class-based understanding of society. Beyond this, many who identify as socialist are actually hostile to Marxism, especially when it comes to internationalism and the need for an independent working-class revolutionary party. And this is not just from those in the DSA on the right, but some from the left as well. The DSA, the U.S.'s largest socialist organization in around 90 years, is not even at the stage of the Second International's debate over Millerandism. Millerandism was the debate over whether or not members of socialist parties should be part of capitalist coalition governments by accepting posts within them. The debate in the Second International was not over whether there should be independent socialist parties. This was largely a given in the Second International. Ultimately, the Second International decided that socialist parties and members of socialist parties should not be part of capitalist coalition governments. The debate within the DSA, which often skirts around this issue, is whether or not the DSA should work within the thoroughly capitalist and imperialist Democratic Party. The arguments against socialist parties participating in capitalist governments that come through in the debates that are in Mike's book, in the Second International, are what I would argue are hindering and even tearing at the DSA. The majority position in the Second International was that working within capitalist coalitions does not push bourgeois parties to the left, but rather pushes socialists to the right. We saw this last fall when the Biden administration crushed what was leading to be a nationwide railroad strike, doing so with votes from DSA affiliated members of Congress and the so-called squad. So here were DSA Congress members not pushing Biden to the left, but having been pushed to the right, and finding themselves crushing what could have been a transformative moment for the labor movement. At the same time, this is very disorienting for people new to politics and not grounded in Marxism. This disorientation, the Second International debates pointed out, can lead radicalizing workers and youth to anarchism. And this is where hostility to Marxism from the left comes from, with many people today being attracted to anarchism. From the DSA, those attracted to anarchism see the role of parties through a purely electoral function and thus reject the concept of a working class party. Marxists understand that the role of a revolutionary party is not to win an election, but to win the revolution. The majority of the Second International also adopted the position that participation in bourgeois parliamentary action absorbs socialist action. So they adopted the position that participation in bourgeois parliamentary action absorbs socialist action. And again, we see this today. As I mentioned, there are large numbers of people in the DSA engaged in a wide range of activist work, trade union work, environmental activism, reproductive rights, transgender rights. They're out there on the ground fighting the good fight. However, in all this work, in my own experiences, I have not seen a discussion as to how we do this work as socialists. And how does this work draw people to socialism? So parliamentary action absorbing socialist action is often the DSA's main go-to, primarily in the form of phone banking members of Congress. And we see this in the current conflict in Palestine. Yes, DSA chapters, individual DSA chapters across the country have been active in organizing and participating in Palestinian solidarity actions. However, the main national response of the DSA is to organize phone banks to call DSA members to get them to sign on to the ceasefire resolution of Representative Cori Bush. A ceasefire would be incredibly important, but the real test of the DSA is over militarism. Will DSA electeds break from their previous practice of voting for billions of dollars in military aid, let alone the billions more to the U.S. defense budget? Biden has put forth a bill for $105 billion to Israel and Ukraine. Without a Speaker of the House in the United States, this bill has been on hold. With a Speaker being elected yesterday, the issue will be more than a ceasefire, but direct U.S. aid to the genocide of Palestinians. This is again where we can appreciate and learn from the Second International. While the Second International did not live up to its own resolutions against militarism and war with disastrous results in World War I, it nonetheless produced valuable resolutions on socialist positions against war and militarism. Unfortunately, not only has the DSA, but large sections of the U.S. left have failed to live up to the principles of internationalism in opposition to war and militarism in regards to the conflict in Ukraine. While the socialists of the Second International, led by Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, stood true to the principle of not one person, not one penny to the capitalist war machine, and said it was the duty of socialists to end war immediately. We now have many socialists and many on the left supporting the expansion of the imperialist NATO alliance and for the U.S. arming Ukraine. The interest and the self-determination of Ukraine in the lives of Ukrainian people at all. The U.S. and British governments want a proxy war with Russia that fuels their war industries and furthers their business interests in the region. Marxist socialists are anti-Putin and at the same time anti-NATO, and should be doing everything possible to stop the war now, as done by Liebknecht, Luxembourg, and the Russian Bolsheviks. And this is one of many reasons why Mike's book is so important. Thank you.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country, edited by Alyssa Quart and David Wallace. From the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, Going for Broke gives voice to a range of gifted writers for whom economic precarity is more than just another assignment. Featuring introductions by luminaries including Michelle T., Kianga Yamada Taylor, and Astra Taylor, Going for Broke shows us the costs of income inequality to our bodies and our minds, and demonstrates real ways to change our conditions. As Gabriel Winant puts it, this moving anthology breaks down the barriers between experience and interpretation. Its contributors explore the underside of American society from many angles, but they do more than document hardship. They show how ordinary people who've been exploited and left behind forge understanding and solidarity out of the experience. Find Going for Broke at haymarketbooks.org.
Just want to remind folks before we go to our final speaker that we will have time after the presentations for answering questions. If you do have questions, please just put them into the chat on the bottom of the screen, and we will get those to our panel in the second part. Okay, so you've been waiting all this time at long last. The editor of the book, Mike Tabor. We'll hear from last. Mike Tabor has edited and prepared a number of books related to the history of revolutionary and working class movements, from collections of documents of the Communist International under Lenin to works by James P. Cannon, Leon Trotsky, Malcolm X, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Maurice Bishop, and Nelson Mandela. Take it away, Mike.
First, I'd like to express my appreciation to David, Ann, and Tom for their thought-provoking presentations. They've each raised important things to think about. And thanks also to Haymarket Books. I'll start by agreeing with what Sean said earlier, that the main target audience for the book we're discussing today consists of activists and people committed to the struggle for social change. The book will also be of value to scholars and students of socialist history, of course, but I strongly believe that supporters of and participants in the struggle can get the most out of it. The five debates recorded in Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism are all on issues that remain with us today and are just as pressing, if not more so. That's one reason for the book's relevancy, but that's not the only reason. In recent years, the Second International has become a much contested issue. Some look to it as a model for what a mass socialist movement should be and hope to recreate it in one form or another. Others think it may be interesting historically, but that it has little value for our time. And there are a whole host of different opinions on the degree to which the Second International, or at least its left wing, is a forebearer of the modern revolutionary socialist movement. I hope that the book we're discussing today, together with my earlier book on the Second International, can help point the way toward answering questions on the Second International's legacy as well as its meaning for today. The earlier book, published in 2021, titled Under the Socialist Banner, was a collection of all the resolutions adopted by Congresses of the Second International from 1889 to 1912. This collection shows the essentially Marxist character of the vast majority of the resolutions adopted, which helps explain the fact that Lenin, Rosa Luxemburg, and other left-wing socialists and communists never renounced the resolutions it adopted in the years before 1914. That's one side of the question, an important one, but the resolutions alone don't give the full picture. And in that, I believe the new book helps round out the story. For one thing, we see more clearly the Second International not just as a historical object, but as a living movement, one confronting challenges, disputes, debates. This is something that many here this afternoon or evening will be familiar with. What we see from the debates in this book is the emergence of distinct political trends in the Second International. A reformist and opportunist trend versus a revolutionary trend. And alongside these two, a centrist current straddling the two poles, but adapting to the openly opportunist one in practice more and more, as David pointed out. Seeing these two sides of the Second International, the Marxist character of the resolutions, along with the growing polarization within the movement, makes it possible to more clearly appreciate its strengths and weaknesses. I go into these in the introduction to each of the two books. Among the strengths I point to are unifying the international workers' movement under the banner of Marxism, popularizing the movement's revolutionary strategic aim, and showing the potential power of the organized working class. As to some of its weaknesses, the lack of a clear perspective on the role of revolutionary action and of the relationship between reform and revolution. The fact that it never became a truly world movement with an underappreciation of the colonial and semi-colonial worlds. And finally, the gap between the Second International's words and its deeds. Seeing these contradictions through each of the five debates helps us understand the Second International's collapse and betrayal in 1914. When its leading parties supported their own country's war efforts in the first global imperialist slaughter that we know of as World War I. Turning more specifically to the book we're discussing today, I myself find the debate format to be extremely useful for presenting the sharply counterposed views. Readers can clearly see the different perspectives being fought out in a graphic, and I might add, entertaining way. In this book, I think the debates break down into three categories. The two debates on colonialism and on immigration are over basic questions of socialist principle primarily, and offer stark yes or no alternatives. Do you support restrictions on immigration of non-white peoples or not? Do you support colonialism or not? There's not much room for middle ground here, obviously, although readers will be able to see various nuances that are quite interesting. Two other debates in the book involve primarily questions of strategy and tactics. I'm referring to those dealing with Milleraudism, ministerialism, and women's suffrage. These raise important questions about the degree to which socialists compromise their principles in the interests of expediency and how to reach one's objective, and even what that objective is. Finally, there's the debate on war and militarism, which involves all of these things at the same time. This is the most complex of the five debates. It raises questions on the nature of war in general and on capitalist war in particular. It poses the question of what positions socialists should take on them, and it deals with what should be done in the fight to prevent war, and if war can't be prevented, how to oppose it in a way that can advance the revolutionary movement. While these debates are all different, there are common questions posed, as Dave has pointed out. What is the movement's aim, reform or revolution? Mobilizing the working class and its allies to fight for revolutionary change, or petitioning and lobbying the rulers for a few reforms? And how should reforms themselves be seen, as the main goal or as byproducts of the revolutionary struggle? And finally, are social change and basic reforms achieved by moderating one's views and showing how reasonable you are? Or as Clara Zetkin eloquently states in the book, do they come from the power the working class is able to mobilize? For me, one of the more interesting aspects of the book consists of the graphic depictions of the different trends and their representatives. The open racism of Van Kol and Hillquit, the ultra-leftism of Hervé, the firmness and clarity of Luxembourg and Zetkin. And you can see the contradictions too. Babel presents a clear revolutionary stance in the Millerandism debate, but is weaker on colonialism and on war. Jaurès openly defends reformism on the question of ministerialism, but later in the book stresses the need for effective anti-war action. Ledebour is solid on colonialism, but less so on the question of war. Many readers will also be interested in getting a better picture of the left-wing forces within the Second International, individuals who eventually became leaders of the communist movement, people like Rosa Luxemburg, Clara Zetkin, Lenin, Karl Radek, Christian Rakovsky, and others. These are individuals I myself have always identified with, and seeing their participation in these debates certainly adds to my appreciation. I want to come back to what I said at the beginning, that this book is of particular value to activists and proponents of revolutionary social change. All of the speakers have mentioned a number of things of these things along these lines. That's not surprising, since each one of these debates contains many valuable lessons we can learn from. I'd like to call attention to something else that may not be so obvious, but I think it's actually a valuable point for socialists. And it stems from the fact that the Second International was what we don't have today. It was a mass working class movement supported by the majority of the world's organized working class, something that we all hope we'll see again. Each debate clearly shows the left and right wings within the Second International. But in the course of each debate, the participants never speak of the problem in society as being left versus right. They speak in class terms, working class versus capitalist class. That's something I think would greatly benefit socialists today to do more often, seeing more clearly who we're trying to appeal to and organize, and who and what we're fighting against. On one side, the force that has the power to change society is not the left in itself, but the working class and its numerous allies among the oppressed and exploited, in their millions. On the other side, our primary enemy is not the right per se, but the capitalist ruling class and its government. Rightist forces certainly represent a danger that needs to be recognized and fought, but we should always remember that behind them stands the whole edifice of the capitalist system they're defending. Anyway, I hope the book we're discussing properly assessing the Second International with all its strengths and weaknesses can contribute to this process. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike. Lots more to dig into. And I just want to echo what Mike said. If you're reading this debate in the book, you'll also often find yourself laughing out loud. There's a lot of hilarious quips in here. If you want to find out who gets called an electoral and accounting machine, a party of cash registers and parliamentary seats, you'll have to pick up a coffee. Okay, so before we go into some questions, I just want to give the panelists an opportunity to respond to each other's presentations. If you had anything that you wanted to dig into, we should have time to do that first.
So, Sean, I'll just come back really on one of Mike's final points and just spend a moment on it, which is the idea that we start to see a kind of crystallization of a variety of political currents within the Second International. And that's what's so dynamic about reading these debates, is you've got people who are starting from adherence to the same formal resolutions quite often. But when the debates are getting concretized, they're discovering that the meaning in practice of resolution, say, against participation in bourgeois governments or around opposition to war and so on, actually are revealing quite significant differences. But of course, we know how the story ends in 1914. They don't. They're living through it. And as a result, we're seeing them begin to formulate some of the key axes of difference. And that's why I was really trying to emphasize the way in which, if you look in the debates at what particularly Clara Zetkin and Rosa Luxemburg are saying, it's the classic point whether socialists support reforms. Of course we do. Every serious socialist wants to see working class benefiting reforms. But, says Luxemburg, the key question is over the struggle for reforms, the modalities of struggle by which reforms are won. And she denounces quite passionately the idea that elected representatives of social democracy are the bringers of reforms to the grateful masses, and says instead that the key thing is unleashing the power of the working class struggling for itself for these reforms, because therein lies the power to transform society. And so I want to emphasize those differences are not 100% clear in 1904 and 1907. But as we read the debates, we can see the crystallization, I think, of these currents. And I just loved, like Sean, you were just saying, I love to see the exchanges that are happening, because these are Marxists of different sort of complexions engaging these debates, you know, in the thrust and parry of argument on the floor of a Congress. But on the larger scale, we can see these are all leading us to the explosion and the implosion that will happen in 1914 with, as Mike says, the majority leaderships of those parties endorsing imperialist war.
Thanks, David. I think Anne wanted to hop on, and then maybe we can go to Tom. That sounds
okay,
great.
What I wanted to come back to was the question of women's suffrage, and to point to the manner in which you can see a great problem with the International in terms of the divorce between what it said it was stood for and what it actually did. Because before 1907, which is covered the debate in 1907, the women's conference, the first of the women's conferences. Before then, there had been at least three resolutions committing the International to struggle for women's suffrage as a universal suffrage campaign. And they had actually, nothing had been done In Germany, yes. In Austria, I'm not sure, but that was a different question. But in any event, nothing had been done. So then in the end, Zetkin and Alexander Kollontai and others decided that they had to take things further and set up these women's conferences as a way to push that agenda, because it wasn't happening, obviously, for political reasons, also for, like, you know, the fact that women wasn't really recognized as a serious question within the international. Women were seen as backward, and there were lots of concerns among trade unionists in particular countries that a vote for women would mean a vote for the right wing, and that socialists would lose votes. Women had to be educated, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I mean, Zetkin deals with all of these, but it shows you that there was a certain paralysis of action when it came to it. Everybody put their hands up for universal suffrage, but it wasn't implemented until she really pushed it in 1907. Thanks.
So I'll come back to this issue of debates right here, and how Mike pointed out how within these debates, they're not necessarily focused on the right or the left, but speaking to the entire working class. And this is something we need to kind of relearn and be a part of and not be afraid of today. Speaking just my own experiences kind of in current day activism, there's a real kind of, I don't know, pressure to not debate. Or for us, can't we all just get along? Or if you bring up some kind of heated argument, that's something that we should avoid. And that's what's great about this book. It's a book of debates. And at the same time, when they're all still in an organization together, when you're organization together, I mean, it's great if you make a friend in it. But what's more important is to see people as your comrade. You can have these intense debates, and yeah, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to go hang out with them after the meeting, but they're going to be your comrade still at the end. And so I think that's this book is important to kind of giving us that experience and that lessons of we need to debate these.
Mike raised that perhaps today people think about social change in terms of left and right, and a lot of these debates indicated an orientation around the working class versus capital. So I guess that for me raises a question around how we define the working class, how they define the working class, and the question of universalist politics at the time. So in several of these debates, notably the immigration and women's suffrage debates, they touch on the formal inclusion or exclusion of wide layers of the working class in political organizing. So my question is, to what extent are all socialist debates of this era in the early 1900s marked by a fundamental category error, the idea that they were organizing the working class when in reality what they were dealing with was a small subsection of the working class, not just on the international scale, as I think people have pointed out, but even within the countries of Western Europe, excluding, for example, oftentimes women, immigrants, perhaps even the unemployed. And what does that do to the thinking of and the universalizability of these kinds of frameworks? Go ahead, Mike.
I would add youth to that list too, because at the time, youth were largely, to the extent that they were working, as apprentices. Were abysmally exploited by not just by the bosses, but by masters and everything else. But I think this sort of this corporatist conception was something that certainly developed in wings of the social democratic movement of that time in Germany and Britain and many other countries. And you see it, I think, Anne referred to sort of the protectionist view of in the immigration debate, which is certainly one side of it. But you see the counterposed view of, one side, how do you view immigrant workers? Do you exclude them as unorganizable as threats to the native working class, or do you embrace them as fellow workers who could be won to the struggle, which was how it was posed in the debates. Similarly with the question of working women and women in general, Anne pointed out to the fact that many male socialists were very suspicious of giving votes to women because they figured they would just vote for the right wing parties. So do you see the debate? Do you see the fight for women's emancipation as less important and diversionary, or do you see the fight as inseparable from the struggle of the working class as a whole? But I think that these counterposed conceptions can be seen on virtually every issue to one extent or another, which is, David pointed out, as you see these debates crystallizing, and and I think we can all recognize these trends as they're emerging because we see these trends, we see them very visibly today.
Yeah. Sean, I might add that you can see at key points in some of the debates, the echoes of a key argument that Rosa Luxemburg makes in her mass strike pamphlet after she participates in the mass strikes of 1905 into early 1906 in Russian-occupied Poland. And in that debate, Rosa Luxemburg is arguing repeatedly that German social democracy is overly obsessed with the sections of the working class that are already in unions. And that what the mass strikes in Russia have shown is the incredible mobilizational capacities of the unorganized. And she enumerates all of these layers, including, clerks in lawyers' offices and so on, who are now coming out into the strike. So that conception that Rosa Luxemburg is putting forward, where she says over and over again that this kind of mass insurgency is what builds organization, whereas the German movement thinks that organization is an end in itself, rather than understanding that mass strike upheaval builds organization overnight. And she literally uses that term, overnight. But part of what she's emphasizing is exactly what you've raised, Sean, that if you're simply obsessed with who's organized today, without any sense of the huge mobilizational capacities of those who are not organized. And of course, we've been seeing that, in the United States, where all of a sudden workers at Amazon, Starbucks, Apple stores, Trader Joe's, and so on are coming into union activism and union organizing. And we're seeing, Starbucks Workers United, for example, putting out one of the best labor statements on Palestine.
Thanks, David. Okay, well, I do want to pick up on something that many of you have raised, which is that throughout, the book is titled Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism, Debates in the Second International. And within all five of the debates that are carefully curated and presented here, the revolutionary wing and what we could describe as the opportunist wing are pretty clearly divided. And though different people land on different sides through different debates, as Mike pointed out, I guess the question, though, for me is the word reform, how that's understood, how that understanding develops through the course of these debates. So I guess I just wanted to ask a question about that aspect, specifically how the different forces understand that term, what reforms are, what the bounds of those reforms are. So, for example, as some have raised already in the women's suffrage debate, limited suffrage for property-owning women is raised as a possible compromise between various wings. But Zetkin forcefully argues that limited suffrage is actually a step backward because it reinforces the property classes and divides the movement. other reforms are not so controversial, you know, reducing armaments, et cetera. But what kinds of logic stands behind the different understandings of reform? Was that something that was really prominent and discussed as far in terms of the panelists' scholarship? And, you know, and any other comments on this concept of reform and how it was understood in those debates? Maybe we can start with Anne.
Yeah, so I just wanted to speak again about the fight for universal suffrage. So basically, within the international, there was a tendency, particularly represented by British, or they call themselves English, socialists from the Fabian Society, and they had argued in 1907, they had argued that basically that they should support the suffragettes in Britain who were fighting for a limited vote based on property rights. And then they lost that vote. And then in 1910, they went back and they basically said that, well, it became apparent that despite the fact that they lost the vote, and they went ahead and campaigned for the suffragettes anyway. So I suppose that shows you the problem with the lack of centralism, you know, the problem from the point of view of taking action as an international. But anyway, Zetkin's arguments against this being treated in this way, you know, in an incremental way, are very interesting and very enlightening in terms of how she sees the question of democracy for the working class. So she sees that democracy is a key component to win socialism, and women, all women, must have the same democratic rights as all men. And therefore, like, in that sense, it doesn't matter, you know, whether women are like not political or right wing or anything like that. You've got to win them to socialism, but you've got to give them the opportunity to have that political say. And then the second thing is that she wants the international, the socialists, to take the lead on the question of political rights for all women. And I think that she's saying, as you mentioned, Sean, that a vote for women based on a property qualification is not really a vote for women at all as women. It's a vote for them as members of the bourgeoisie, as property people. So it's a different, it's kind of like, you know, I think that the quote that Rosa Luxemburg is famous for, you know, that reform and revolution, they may seem like there is, the fights are very different, they end up in different places. So therefore, this question is another one where you start off from the position of a universal democratic right, and then you take the leadership of that movement. You don't kind of go, oh, we'll take this crumb off the table, like as a step forward, that the rights for the bourgeois women of property would be a step forward for working class women. As far as Zetkin was concerned, these things are completely counterposed because they represent different classes. Anyway, so that would be my exposition of my view of what she was trying to get over there. Thank you.
Yes, Tom?
Yeah, as David said earlier, I mean, socialists were not against reforms. I mean, we want reforms to help alleviate the immediate condition of working class people. But the question is always, how do socialists fight for reforms? And the question of women's suffrage is a good example. You can kind of counterpose it to today in the fight for reproductive rights, where you'll go now, especially large, lost Roe versus Wade here in the United States. And the rallies that and protests that happened afterwards, what people were saying, the main speakers at these rallies were saying, vote, go vote, 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 is like, that was how to regain abortion rights. Well, that's been the strategy for a long time for much of the kind of the main kind of stream, like Democratic leadership of the abortion rights struggle, just vote for Democrats. Well, look where that got us. I mean, we lost abortion rights. And the struggle for suffrage is a good example of how women won the right to vote without having the vote. It's like they didn't vote to in order to gain the right to vote. And it shows how like socialists engaged in mass struggle and presented it as a universe, as Anne said, a universal democratic right, and how that struggle and how socialists energized that struggle and took it from being just middle class and bourgeois women to a mass struggle of the working class for the right to vote. So I think that's it's always important how you fight for these reforms, and does it mobilize the working class?
Well, I think it's important here to emphasize the fact that the Second International as a whole and its parties never was completely clear on the relationship between reform and revolution. There were various currents, and you see them in each of these debates. I thought the the point people have referred to, David and others have referred, and Anne have referred to Zetkin's comments, in the women's suffrage debates, which are some of the clearest presentations of exactly what you do. And actually, in the discussion on Millerandism, Babel actually makes some of the same points you take whatever you're strong enough to take from the rulers and accept whatever gains you're able to wring out of them without losing sight of what you're fighting for, of viewing reforms as steps along the road to the revolutionary goal. And I think both Tom and David are totally accurate in really emphasizing the key point here is the struggle for the reforms. And the criteria that you use is whether they strengthen the self-confidence and organization of the, of the working class along meeting these things. And that's really what we keep our eyes on.
Just on a quick footnote, because it comes right out of Tom's comments, of course, around the reproductive rights rallies that end with vote, vote, vote. Had some of our biggest gains over reproductive rights in the last few years in Argentina, Chile, and Mexico, and these have been essentially working class feminist upheavals. In other words, they're led by women, but with significant support from unions and other social movement organizations, so they become mass struggles in the streets. And that really fits with the point that Mike was just making about it's the struggle for reforms that is the key.
Thank you all. Maybe directly off of that, I do want to pose a question about self-activity as it was represented or not represented in these debates. In the debates, I'm thinking particularly of the colonialism debate, the immigration, women's suffrage especially, there seems to be a kind of representative political logic or stellvertretend vicarious politics, the idea that politics is something that is done for working people, that doesn't consider the self-activity of working and oppressed people. The 1907 Stuttgart Congress occurs already 2 years, notably, into the Swadeshi movement in India, especially in Bengal. And that was a movement of workers and peasants who were engaged in mass civil disobedience, in boycotts, in strikes at jute mills, and even armed resistance. But the possibility for colonized people to liberate themselves doesn't really seem to feature meaningfully or inform the debates here, especially for the kind of more conservative wings who are talking about the civilizing mission. similar blind spots I think are evident in the immigration debates and women's suffrage debates. And so I'm wondering if you all have thoughts on the role of self-activity, how it featured in these discussions, even if that term wasn't necessarily prominent at the time, and what kind of strategic priority was placed upon that in the Second International. Mike, do you want to start? And then maybe we can follow up with Anne.
Okay, well, I'll just to kick it off, the predecessor of the Second International, the First International, it's the Constitution it adopted as its very first point was that, you know, the classic statement actually was written by Marx, that the emancipation of the working class must be conquered by the working class itself. And that was the standard position that guided the, you know, resolutions of the Second International. Now, you know, of course, in practice, as we see there, you know, the numerous, the blind spots that come in, particularly with, you see it most glaringly, of course, in the colonialism debate, where even the best forces in the debate, you know, those who are opposed to the colonialism perspective, didn't really present the point of view of the colonial masses as agents of their own liberation. And this was actually the only, there's actually only very few leaders of the Second International put forward this position. One of them was Lenin, who at the time was a member of the International Socialist Bureau, the executive body of the Second International. He presented this opinion, but you don't really see it in the debates that are in this book. So it is one of the glaring things, which I know that when the Third International was founded, they made a special point of really trying to reverse this perspective.
So I could just chip in there on that. I think that's from my reading of the debates, and that's so clear that basically the question of the working class in the colonial countries taking things into their own hands is something that's really pushed back against. And there is this idea that there's a need for capitalism to progress in those countries, and that needs to be done somehow under the leadership or care and control of the colonizer. And so I think that, you know, yeah, that they are seen as like the kind of question of backwardness. You know, they're backward, and therefore because they're backward, you know, I'm not saying they're backward, I'm saying they said they were backward and they hadn't developed and come forward under the, you know, as they hadn't become capitalist countries, and therefore they needed to go through capitalism, but they also were kind of like infantile, and therefore they couldn't really control their own affairs. They had to be taught. And I think that definitely is something that you can see in almost all of the contributions, with the exception of Lenin. And even, I think, am I right to think that Babel was a little bit, you know, soft on this question as well. And I wondered as well, like on that, whether they saw Marx, you know, the development of capitalism being necessary, you know, in that sense, in a very formal sense, and such a formal sense that every other country in the world had to follow the path of the Western nations. And of course, then because perhaps of that and other things, and you know, the racism that they had, particularly in the colonial countries, that they were not willing to let go of the reins of those colonial countries, and even wasn't there an idea that there would be socialist colonialism, you know, which is bizarre. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. I think so. We have about 7 minutes left. Maybe we can wrap up. We did get a question from the audience here from Steve Lee. kind of the classic question from the Second International. He says, it seems that Lenin learned from the collapse of the Second International that a party made up exclusively of revolutionaries was necessary rather than a mixed party led by revolutionaries. Do you agree? And I just want to pair that a little bit with something that I think is worth noting about, as has come up here, is that one of the most impressive things about the Second International was the sheer fact of its unity, that they brought all these different trends together and they remained within the same organization. You know, there are sharp disagreements on almost every single question being debated in the Congresses represented in the book, with even some declaring others outside the bounds of socialism. I think, you know, in some cases that may be polemical excess, in some cases that may be justified. It's notable that, for example, both the 1904 and the 1907 Congresses are happening during the reign of King Leopold II of Belgium, who was engaged in unspeakable atrocities in the Congo. And the Belgian socialists are meanwhile talking about the benefits of colonialism. I think that like that, it's stuff like that that raises this question for Lenin and the left wing of the International around the boundaries of how much unity is possible. At the same time, there were clear benefits to having a broad party international with different trends that could engage in these debates, that could develop their politics together and didn't all agree. And so I guess just along those lines, how do you all think today about those kinds of questions, the unity of the Second International, the clear problems with those unities, you know, for example, the Bolsheviks' lessons that they took about the Revolutionary Party out of this experience?
That's the question that we're always faced with right now. How do we build a mass party since we don't have a mass party? It's probably some of the silence because it's something we probably all think about all the time. I think it's I'm all for left unity at this point right now in the struggle. I really wish we could come together around issues and around issues that unite us. I mean, fighting racism, fighting for reproductive rights, fighting imperialist war. I mean, these are broad things that I believe could unite the left and then have factions within it. Because then I think Lenin is right. When you come to this point of taking power, that's when you need a revolutionary party of revolutions. But as you're building towards that, we need unity and broadness. And that's how you build a party of revolutionaries, by going through action together, by going through struggle together. And that's how you get to the party of revolutionaries. Not right now build a party of revolutionaries where, okay, do you have this checklist of things that you meet in order to be a part of the same organization with me? That becomes more important when we're actually talking about taking power, which I do hope we'll get to. I'm not talking to, so.
Yeah, if I can just come in quickly, because I think we should give Mike the last word.
Yes.
I do draw from these debates the conclusion that a revolutionary party needs the kind of politics of Rosa Luxemburg, Clara Zetkin, Lenin, that kind of political clarity around the key questions of state power and revolutionary change and the agency of the working class, those are fundamental. But I think we all who are serious on the question recognize that the road to getting there is going to involve very complex processes of the recomposition of the working class movement and the recomposition of a radical left. And as a result, none of us have a roadmap for how we get there. We're going to need much larger working class left formations out of which the question of a party can be built. You know, in very short order, coming out of the collapse of the Second International and the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, we had a party of several hundred thousand revolutionaries in the Communist Party of Germany. Gramsci's party in Italy had some tens of thousands, and it was considered a small party in the International. So that's the real challenge. The self-anointment of small groups declaring themselves to be the Revolutionary Party is not the way forward. We're going to need to be figuring out what kind of broad-based working class left formations can be developed out of which revolutionary currents can crystallize in a meaningful way.
I just want to say something very briefly. I think that the question of unity in the Second International was because of it being the organized working class. And also, I think that the Marxists did win a lot of the debates. And therefore, I think that they saw potential to win over the majority. And I think that what the Second International shows you is that Marxism is practical. It has practical solutions for the here and now that seem ambitious and out of kilter with today's world because of the weakness of our movement. But I think that they are eminently practical. And therefore, for me, I think, yes, you want a mass party, but I think that it needs to be based on a program of Marxism, which, and that is because I think it is practical. Thank you.
Well, I think that the on this question of unity, there's really two almost distinct, you know, angles of coming at this. One is that what's clearly necessary is to build the broadest possible unity and action around struggles that come up, whether it's opposition to the murderous Israeli attack in Gaza, whether it's, you know, in defense of abortion and reproductive rights, whether in opposition to, you know, imperialist war and so forth, that needs to draw in the greatest number of forces, the unions, the need to look at the union struggles, like the very inspiring struggle of the UAW today, that these things pose the possibilities of and show you know what's going to be possible in the years ahead. As to building the party, I share David's opinion that there's no roadmap, there's no recipe that you have it. Clearly, it's impractical to have in one party people who opposition to imperialist oppression and supporters of imperialism. It's, you can't have in one party people who are cave into the anti-immigrant campaign and those who are fighting for immigrant rights. So I mean, those are some of the lessons that clearly the left wing in the Second International came to the conclusion to, which I still think, you know, is very much relevant today. But it will take coming to the recognizing the new possibilities in the years ahead and the periods ahead is an important thing. And in this way, to try to link up to the legacies, tradition, to study what we've been through, I think is extremely valuable.
Thanks for that, Mike. And thanks to all the panelists for this excellent discussion. I just want to close out with another appeal. If you are serious about changing the world and want to build the kinds of forces that our side is going to need, you have to root yourself in history. And there is no better way to do that than looking at what predecessors all around the world were debating, the ways that they interacted with each other and the world around them. And this book, you know, is a great place to start. When you finish it, check out the minutes of the Communist International that Mike Tabor also had a hand in. But this is the place to start. It pairs very well with the resolutions. They make great stocking stuffers. So head on over to haymarketbooks.org and get your copy of Reform, Revolution, and Opportunism. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.